When the Allied American, British and Australian troops in Afghanistan, who were pursuing Osama bin Laden from one end of the country to the other, came across an Australian citizen, one of their own number, fighting for and with the Taliban and not against the Taliban, they probably could not have been more amazed. It was December 2001, you might remember, and the man's name was David Hicks. Hicks had converted to Islam in 1999. He changed his name to Muhammad Dawood and turned up, of all places, in Afghanistan to fight the Western enemy, his home people. Captured soon by the Afghan Northern Alliance, Hicks was sold to the US military for $1,000. He spent the next 7 years in the famous Guantanamo prison before coming back to Australia in all that hoo-ha and fanfare and serving out the rest of his sentence in a prison in Adelaide before he was released and married and eventually wrote a book, his autobiography. Imagine the surprise and the amazement of the Allied troops, if you can. Fancy finding, in the remotest part of Afghanistan, a citizen of the free West fighting against them, for the enemy. Of course, it made the headlines then and became something of a political matter in our own land when he was due to come home. But the news reports that followed his capture at that time, of course, posed the question everybody wanted answered. How was it possible that an Australian man would end up in a situation like this? What factors influenced him? What choices did he make that led him down the path that he eventually chose, meaning that in the end he swapped sides and fought against his country? You wonder that too if he ever asked himself that question. How did I get into this situation? And you wonder if when they captured him, they asked him the question, what's a guy like you doing in a place like this? Doing what you're doing. Well, there's another David, and he's David who's going to be king. And he's in 1 Samuel 27 and 28. And we read of him today and we wonder the same thing. What's a guy like him doing in the Philistine country? Fleeing to the Philistine country. Forming an alliance with the king of Gath. You're almost forced to ask the question, what has gone wrong with David? Situation is so bad for David now in chapter 27. In chapter 28, those first two verses, that we read how David is getting himself ready to go and do battle with the Philistines. But the only problem is that David is not a soldier in Saul's army. David is going to be fighting his own people in the Philistine army. David has found himself a member of the Philistine army. And he's going to do battle against the Israelite army. That's the situation we leave him in chapter 28, verse 2. And more than that, the chapter ends on this personal assurance that David gives to this Philistine king that he is ready and willing to show what he and his men can do. You know what I can do, he said to the king. You know how I can fight. Now we ask the question, what's a fellow like David, who's going to be king over Israel, doing in a place like that? That's the question. What's he doing? Well, the story so far, last week we've just come down from one of David's spiritual highs. Chapter 26 has been that spiritual high point for David. He showed his complete loyalty to Saul by refusing to take the opportunity to kill him a second time. Not kill him a second time, but you know what I mean, the second time to kill him. You would think that Saul would now call the chase off. After all, he just doesn't seem to be getting anywhere. And for David, in spite of all the confirmations he has received to be Israel's next king, the pressure is all too much. And he's driven to make some choices and decisions from inside the pressure cooker. Generally, we don't make good decisions when we're inside the pressure cooker. When life stress reaches up to here, the decisions we make are not necessarily going to be good. And that's where David made these decisions, inside a pressure cooker. And in these decisions, there are lessons that God has for us as well. Think of these three decisions that David made. The first was whether to run or to hide. Whether to run or to hide. There was a close proximity between the events of chapter 26 and chapter 27. No significant span of time is indicated between them. And there are no crisis situations that would explain David's sudden change of heart. But it happened that David, who had pleaded with Saul that he not be forced to leave the land of Israel, now felt compelled to leave, even though Saul had just lastly, in the end of the last chapter, said, David, go on your way. David obviously didn't trust whatever Saul said. This is perhaps a clear indication that Saul held the upper hand in this game of cat and mouse, and David feels that he has no control anymore over the decisions that he can make. It's not as though the matter is in his hands anymore. And he could simply choose to go west or south or north or east and just get away from Saul. Saul has so engineered his pursuit of David that David has to flee, he thinks he does anyway, over the border for safety. Now, if you've been following along this series in 1 Samuel, you know that we've done this before. This is another deja vu. 1 Samuel 22, David did that once before. And that episode turned into an almost miserable disaster for him. David survived only because he acted like a lunatic and got out of the place and they let him go. So you would have thought as David arrived at the gates of, or left the gates of Gath in chapter 22, he would have thought to himself as he left those gates, boy, I'll never do that again. I'll never come back here because that was almost disastrous. And yet here he is, a couple of chapters later, with his 600 followers, plus his two wives, and all their wives, and all of them are heading on the road to Gath. 50 kilometres. Yep, we're on the right road. There are two things here, and David is only right in one of them. David is right to think that if he flees to Gath, then Saul will call off the hunt. But being right about that doesn't mean that David is right in fleeing to where he's fleeing to the Philistine territory. No doubt you grew up with the expression, two wrongs don't make a right. And this proved to be the case for David. But it was also true, humanly speaking, he had few options but to go to Gath. So we can understand why he does this, although it's desperate. And as David will find out, desperate measures inevitably have consequences that we do not like. Second, we find David facing this decision in Gath of where to live and where to work. You can imagine that David, his 600 fighting men and all their families, just suddenly arriving in Gath would have made quite an enormous impact upon Gath, especially when David approaches the king with a request. He asks if he can be given a city from which he and his followers can have some freedom and not be under the king's nose. He doesn't want to live in the royal palace with the king. In fact, he can't anyway because there are 600 of them. Imagine that. You're in this little town and 600 from across the border join your town. Imagine the impact in the economy. How hard it is at the public toilets these days. You just can't get in. And it seemed a reasonable request to give to the king, who somewhat generously and apparently with no jokes about David's release from the mental asylum, gives him a city. How generous is that? Yep, I'll give you the city of Ziklag. It's 40 kilometres or so to the south and east of Gath. It's somewhat out of the way of our viewpoint, he seems to say. It's not all that distant from Israel, in fact. And David gains this place of his own in an area where Achish could monitor his activities from a distance, something like a moving far enough away from mum and dad to have a life of your own, but not too far away, a bit like James and Sarah are about to do. But while there, David also needs a means of livelihood. He comes up with an ingenious solution to the problem. Using Ziklag as his headquarters and his base of operations, David and his men can go off into the region surrounding Ziklag and raid the cities and the camps of Israel's enemies and defeat them and take all their goods. It seems like the perfect win-win situation. David could live in safety in Ziklag, protected from Saul, because Saul won't come into the Philistine territory, and then he can launch out and fight the enemies of Israel at the same time. On the surface of things, this looks great. What a perfect solution for David. But scratch beneath the surface, and there's a problem. See, David at the same time is actively deceiving the king that he's fighting the enemies of the Philistines, including Israel. And while we're not told so in the text, it will not be long before we are told that David shares some of the spoils of war with the very people he is supposed to be killing, his own flesh and blood. And so there's this dramatic contrast between the way David presents his activities to the king and the actual way that David is living. Deception. And deception is a dangerous and a slippery path to follow. Like climbing along a craggy outcrop of rocks. A one slip either way, to the left or the right, and it could be the end of you. David, on the one hand, convinces the king he is fighting fellow Israelites, leading the king to conclude he is making himself odious, a stench among his people. They must really hate David now, after what he's doing to them, his own people. Imagine that. But on the other hand, the truth is very different. This is the fine line of deception that David has backed into in order to survive. The scriptures do not commend him for it, but they do not condemn him either. And while at times he may have patted himself on the back and his apparent successes, he is about to find out that this little game is far more dangerous than he could ever have imagined. Third, we find David faced with the choice of whether to lie or tell the truth. So far, David's been getting away with his lies and deception. But now the crunch time has come. When the king says to him, "Come, David, grab your men, let's go attack Israel," what else could he say? If he said, "Look, actually, I've got an appointment for my hair, doing, you know, a different style that day, and I really can't get out of it," then the king would have reason to suspect that David had been lying to him all along. And yet this hole that he's dug for himself means that he's well and truly deep in the hole, and he cannot get out of it any other way except to what? Dig some more. He has no other option. He simply cannot turn and fight his own people. He can't do that. He's going to reign over those people. He's going to be their king. And to make matters even worse, the Philistine king not only informs David of his plan to attack Israel, but he honours David by making him and his men the attacking division of his army, as well as giving David the privilege of being what? Oh, the king's bodyguard. For life. But it gets worse. You think he's in a deep enough hole. What's his next words? He says to the king, "Very well, you will see what your servant can do." Boy. And it's this point that we're compelled to ask the question, what in the world is a guy like him doing in a place where he's become the armor bearer and the bodyguard of the enemy, of the king of the enemy? David surely has lost the plot, or so it seems. It's only because of the intervening hand of God that's revealed in chapter 29 that David is spared crashing through the ice. The ice has been thin all along, but now it's wafer thin. Now it's razor sharp. And only God can do something to save him out of this mess. We'll come to that in a couple of weeks. But what we glean from this is, of course, the truth always comes to light. Be sure of that. The truth will always come to light. Sometimes it happens in this life, and the man put away for murder is found not guilty. We just had that a week or two ago. How long was he in prison? 18 years. Sometimes it doesn't happen in this life, and the innocent are left to flounder. But regardless of whether it does or doesn't happen in this life, the truth will come out eventually at the day of the judgment seat of Christ, when all that is true will be revealed. Samuel had said to Saul way back in chapter 15, "Be sure your sins will find you out." And he probably didn't know at the time how appropriate that would be for David, who was anointing as king, when that king called upon David to go and fight his own people. So what does the author intend the passage to teach the readers of his day and to us? If David is skirting on the edge and digging himself a hole, in what ways has David failed? Well, there are four things. You might like to fill them in on your outline. First of all, David fell into solitary syndrome. He fell into solitary syndrome. David was often on the receiving end of ministry to him by others. There was Samuel, who was not only the one who anointed him as the king, but to whom David could flee when Saul was pursuing him. There was Abiathar, the surviving heir of Ahimelech, who joined David along with the ephod. There was Jonathan, who stood beside him, assuring him that he would be the next king. There was Abigail, his wife, who greatly encouraged David to do right as the next king. Even though David had had all these people in his life, he seems now to have withdrawn into himself. He suffers from what I call the Lone Ranger syndrome. It's that false sense of being alone in your spiritual struggle, in your pain or your suffering. Even the prophet Elijah was struck with this malady, leading to this principle. Whenever we think we are alone in our spiritual struggles, we are self-deceived and we are ripe for a terrible fall. And whenever we think we're alone, it's just me, God, there's no one else. That's dangerous stuff. David seems to be in that Lone Ranger frame of mind. He is certainly not seeking wise counsel or the will of God. Second, David forgot things he should have remembered. He forgot things he should have remembered. This is a very serious malady, isn't it? To forget what you should remember. The nation Israel constantly forgot how the Lord faithfully led them and provided for them in the past, even their very recent past. And now David has forgotten the words the Lord spoke to him through Samuel and others. He has forgotten how the Lord saved him time and time again from Saul. He has forgotten the instruction of the prophet Gad to leave the stronghold and return to Judah and trust God. He has forgotten his own words, spoken not so many chapters back, of the blessedness of being in the land of Israel and the curse of being forced to leave it. He appears to have forgotten the disaster it was the last time he went to the king of the Philistines. And that leads to this principle. Forgetfulness of God's commands and God's promises is often the starting point for serious failure. Forgetfulness. What have you forgotten that you should be remembering? I'm not talking about your mobile or your PIN. I'm talking about in terms of things that God has promised to you through his word. Have you forgotten them? Third, David closed his eyes to the consequences of his actions. He closed his eyes to the consequences of his actions. He minimized the seriousness of his error. David does not purpose to fall or to fail. David does not purpose to end up being part of the Philistine army, headed for battle with Saul and Jonathan and the rest of his friends. He doesn't purpose these things. All he intends to do is get out of the frying pan, but he jumps into the fire instead. See, sin has a way of opening one door to another and another. This is the way it is with David. The situation just keeps going from bad to worse, and David gets so deep in it, it doesn't look like there is a way out. It all starts with what appears to be a minor lapse in faith, and it ends in a most serious situation. Ultimately, his decision is based on sight, isn't it? There's a principle there, isn't there? When we look at our circumstances and forget to look at God, we end up in all sorts of problems. To top it all off, David lost sight of the need to persevere. He faces one of the greatest enemies that believers ever face. It's not the devil. It's weariness. It's weariness. Here is a picture of a man who is not blown out, he's burnt out. He seems to have given up. Many have done before him. Many will do after him. He seems to have left behind his spiritual fervor, as the reading from Romans 12 put it to us today. Never flag in zeal, say the scriptures. Never flag in zeal. Put all these lessons together, and what principle do you come up with? Come up with this. That even those with a sincere heart for God are never far from the possibility of falling. Even those with a sincere heart for God are never far from the possibility of failing. But to counter that possibility, keep in mind that the good news is this, that when our faith fails, God remains faithful. His grace is ever and always sufficient. He never changes. He never grows tired or weary, though we do. He can lift up the fallen soldier, the wounded warrior, the confused disciple, the fearful saint. Therefore, we are to cast ourselves on him who is faithful and who gives strength to the weary. He can help us run, says Isaiah 40, and not grow tired, walk and not grow weary. And in his strength, even our weakness can be made strong. Yes, it is a two-way street. God holds us in his grip, but let us not be like David, and in the pressure cooker that life is, lose our grip on his grace.